Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everybody. Glad you could join us again. Welcome back to the Money Tree Podcast. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins, and we're going to turn things over to my partner here, Doug Goldstein, in just a moment. But first, have you ever wondered if there's a way to capitalize on all that online chatter of all those posts you see on social media? Well, guess what? Your wait's over, because the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds is now at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund, trades under the ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities which show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment. What does that mean? It means they don't do surveys, they don't guess, they just track the buzz. And the more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of that buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks that had the most bullish score, those get included each month in the index. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ.
Okay, I'm very excited to be talking with Ken French, who is the Roth Family Distinguished Professor of Finance at the Tuck School of Business. That's at Dartmouth. He's also a director of the Dimensional Fund Advisors, which is based in Austin, Texas. But today, Ken, I want to talk to you about portfolio design and really try to understand that if someone wants to develop the most perfect portfolio, what should he do?
The short answer is they should try to figure out how they differ from the average investor. Start with a market portfolio and adjust it for whatever differences they have relative to the average investor.
What does a difference mean?
What I have in mind when I say difference is perhaps somebody's particularly risk averse. The market portfolio that I have in mind, normally people think what you mean by the market is the stock market. What I mean is all financial assets out there. And what I know is the average dollar invested has to hold that broad market portfolio. And the argument is easy. There's no shares laying around in the gutter. There's no bonds stacked on roadsides that nobody's owning. Somebody owns everything. Mm-hmm. So if I aggregate everybody's portfolio, it must be the aggregate of everything. That tells me that the average dollar has to look like a pro rata slice of everything.
When you say everything, everything is kind of a big picture. We've got stocks, bonds, but there's more. There's real estate, there's commodities, there's so much out there. Is that what you mean by everything?
That's exactly what I mean. What I mean, to be precise, is everything that's in positive net supply. And to be clear, for example, a futures contract, every long, there's somebody on the other side of that contract. You can think of it as just a bet. We don't want those side bets in our market portfolio, because they just aren't there if I aggregate everybody up. Options, swaps, anything sort of derivatives where there's a long and a short, those aren't there. But all other financial assets, that's what I have in my mind when I say a market portfolio.
And is someone supposed to try to figure out what the overall allocation is in the world and then make his portfolio look the same way?
Nah, that's too hard. Okay. I think it's pretty easy to just say, ballpark, here's a reasonable portfolio. And really what it's doing when I say start with the market and then figure out how you're different, it leads you a totally different path than if you were saying, well, what's the best mutual fund manager out there? Or which hedge fund should I try to hire? It's a top-down rather than that sort of bottom-up. Which stock should I buy? Or which bonds should I buy? That's the bottom-up approach. And what I'm arguing is you want exactly the opposite. Almost all investors out there really should be saying, boy, that's a market portfolio. How do I differ from the average investor? Maybe I ought to shift my portfolio in that direction.
Well, it sounds to me like you're saying that you want to invest in simply the growth of the world. You're saying, we're here today, tomorrow it's probably going to be better. Let's just get our money invested in it. I don't know where it's going to be, so I can't hire some manager, or, you know, we're in Israel here, we try to hire prophets. I'm not able to I'm not able to do that. So I just want to go in the direction of the economy of the world. Is that a fair way to describe what you're saying?
I actually never think of it in my head as I'm buying the economy of the world, but you can if you want. That just presumes that the return's coming from the growth of the economy. But it could be the economy shrinks this year. But if that shrinkage was anticipated, I should still get a positive return. So I never conflate what, you know, the growth of the economy with the growth of security returns or security prices.
Well, we all know that the markets go up and down over time. And some years, the whole world market doesn't look so stellar. So it has to be, presumably, the model you're describing, which as I'm saying is they invest in the whole world growth, would have to be a long-term portfolio, no?
Even if I were going to do this for the next year, I would have the same mindset. It basically, you're right, it's not something that somebody who wants to trade every hour would have any sense in doing. But in my mind, somebody who's trying to trade every hour, almost everybody who's doing that is just sacrificing money. So it's founded on this notion that it's a notion that Bill Sharpe wrote a paper about back in, I think it was published in 1991, Financial Analyst Journal, that the average dollar invested actively has to lose relative to the average dollar invested passively. And it just comes down to cost. If I have passive investors holding the market portfolio, the aggregate of everybody else has to be the market portfolio. It's that same adding up constraint that I was talking about earlier. If I take my pro rata slice of every asset in the world, what's left over? Every asset in the world in exactly the same proportions that it used to be. If I take a thimble of blue paint out of a bucket, I still have a bucket of blue paint. So I know what my return is going to be. It's going to be the return on the market minus my costs. And I also know what the aggregate of everybody else's return is going to be. It's the return on the market minus their costs. They're out there doing active. They're trading more. They're paying their managers more. All of that creates more costs than my passive market strategy. So I know my return on the market minus my lower cost, is going to be higher than their return, the return on the market minus their higher costs. And that's not a statement that it's a long-run phenomenon. It certainly is a long-run phenomenon, but it literally happens every instant. I know every instant I'm beating the value-weighted average of everybody else.
We're talking with Professor Ken French. He's at Dartmouth College in the Tuck School of Business. He's also a director and a consultant to the Dimensional Fund Advisors based in Austin, Texas. Ken travels around the world doing a lot of talking. And Ken, you've been describing to us this concept of investing perhaps in the whole world and looking at the fees, understanding quite clearly that if people are taking money off the top, whether it's to pay managers or to pay trading costs, that's obviously going to eat into the return of the investor. Let's talk for the next couple of minutes about practically someone who wants to use this model of investing in the world, who actually has specific goals in mind, like saving for retirement or saving for a kid's college education. How can that person translate what you're saying into a real nuts and bolts investment decision?
Basically, what you're saying is, okay, I have somebody who might be different from the average investor out there. They're saving for college. In that sense, they have at least some commitment with a shorter time horizon that somebody else might have. And they might want to adjust their portfolio. Maybe they want to do a ladder strategy on bonds that basically delivers the cash flows that they're going to need when their kid retires. And they might be accumulating that over their child's youth till the kid's 18 or 20 or whatever. But the whole framework here is the reason you're not buying a broad market portfolio at that point is because you're different. You have a particular liability that you're trying to, quote, immunize, that you're trying to lock in here. And you would do that over a period of years with a specific eye to saying, okay, these are the cash flows I'm going to need in the future, and let me build that portfolio. But you wouldn't be buying bonds out there because you thought they were underpriced. That's the key. You'd be buying those bonds because you had specific cash flows in the future that you were trying to basically hedge today with your investment strategy.
Let me try to translate that into the way that I normally describe it. My day job is that I'm a financial advisor. So I sit with people and I talk to them about what their goals are, like sending their kids to college. And then we try to develop an asset allocation model that makes sense. It sounds to me, and I just want to make sure that what you're saying is what I say to people also, is you need to understand specifically what your goals are. And then depending on what they are, take parts of your portfolio or your whole portfolio and design it so that it is built to achieve your goals in the most efficient way possible.
Absolutely. Doug, you've nailed it.
Okay.
And the key there was that last statement, in the most efficient way possible. And for almost all investors, the most efficient way possible is not out there trying to beat the market. It's trying to get the best investment experience by choosing a passive strategy, deviating from the market only because of the sort of arguments you've made.
Well, that presumes that the market, you know, the fear that people have because they're silly enough to actually listen to the media is that things are going badly and they say, oh, you know, I better get out because whatever, you know, there's always something bad in the news. That's what the news likes to sell. And I think we all know that people who invest without the benefit of the news do better than people who actually follow the news. But nonetheless, the average guy in the street reads the average newspaper and is frequently afraid. And then you're saying, yeah, but invest in the market. And he goes, yeah, I would. But, you know, we all know the market's about to go down. I think that's where people really get stuck. Don't you find that?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that somebody thinks we all know the market's going to go down, you just got to ask, why isn't it already in the price?
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that the market will go down. Now, what I always say is I'm sure the market is wrong. I just don't know which way. And a good example of this is in the middle of the financial crisis, clients who wanted to move out of the market because they just had no idea prices could go down the way they did it during the financial crisis. My view was, okay, if that's what you want to do, that's totally fine. If the reason you want to do it is either you've learned markets can be more volatile than you expected, mm-hmm. or your level of risk aversion is higher than you thought. Either way, fine. You were in the wrong portfolio to start with. But now that you've made this adjustment, you should plan to hold that portfolio from here on out. You've learned something either about yourself or the world, and you ought to adjust your portfolio to reflect it. But you shouldn't plan to come back in the market later.
I think that's a great place for us to end today, not because I don't have many more questions, but because we're out of time. Ken, in the last few seconds, just tell us, how can people follow you and follow your work?
I have a website that people use because what I do is provide literally hundreds of return series on my website. And if you just Google my name, Ken French, particularly if you say Ken French Data, that will show up. And then my co-author, Gene Fama, and I have what we call the Fama French Forum. It's just FamaFrenchForum.com, in which we sporadically post things that we're interested in, you know, things that we've written, paragraphs, papers, whatever. Some people might find that interesting.
Okay, we will put links to that at the show notes of today's show. Ken French, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it.
Thanks for that awesome interview, Doug. Hey, if you've ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all the online chatter of the millions of investors out on social media, well, guess what? There is. That same artificial intelligence that's used by some of the world's most sophisticated investors, that's now at your fingertips and you can make their edge your edge. It's called the Buzz Index and it's licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ. It provides investors with a portfolio of securities which show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. No surveys, no guessing. Also, when you go to the Buzz Index, if you're not sure if you want to invest or not yet, you can sign up for their newsletter, which shows you when new buzz happens and you can kind of kick the tires and see, like a lot of people want to see, exactly how the Buzz Index works. Each month, 75 stocks that have the most bullish scores are included in the index. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for the link to the Buzz Index. And more information, that's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. Just a disclaimer, I invest in the Buzz Index. Doesn't make it right for you. Do your own homework, but wanted to make sure you know that. And here with the buzz this week is my good friend, Doug Goldstein.
Thank you very much, Joe. Joe Salci, hi. Tell me before we move on and introduce the rest of our panel, what's going on with you?
I got my coffee and I'm ready to talk investing with you, man.
Ready to roll. All right, let's see what else we have here. Is that Miranda Mark, what I see in the back of the room? Come on up, Miranda.
Hey there. It's nice to be here. It's good. Joe let me out of the basement. I was a special guest on Stacking Benjamins recently and thought I'd be trapped down there forever. But I'm out and it's exciting.
Hey, it's not as creepy as all that.
It sounded very creepy the way you said it.
Mom makes sure everybody's safe in the basement. She comes down and checks every 10 minutes.
That could also be creepy, but let's just not go there. Hey, Linda. Linda P. Jones, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm back from my four-month trip.
Yay.
Back home.
I love four-month trips.
So glad to be home. It's nice.
So Linda P. Jones is actually practicing to go on the Mars launch, and that's why she's taking such long vacations. So 4 months, good for you, living in one of those domes, right?
No. Some people think maybe I'm already on Mars. I don't know.
All right, let's just launch in. We had this cool discussion with Ken French. Ken, you know, is partners with Gene Fama, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and they manage a lot of money, and they're pretty clever about how they do it, but one of the things I think that a lot of people kind of have a philosophy on is what makes a perfect portfolio. So, Linda, let's start with you. What do you see as a perfect portfolio?
Well, I think you made a really good point that a perfect portfolio is different for different people and for people that have different goals and certainly different ages and risk tolerances. But I think there's some basics that we can include in most portfolios. I like to talk about large caps, mid caps, small cap, international, some emerging market, maybe some real estate. Maybe, you know, a few other little sectors in there that you can add to spice up your portfolio. And I think, you know, everyone needs to have the basics. And of course, you can have some short-term bond funds in there as well or some other fixed income. But I think diversification is key. I think covering all the asset classes is key. And I think that is what makes up a perfect portfolio.
So you're covering all the asset classes. Ken also certainly thinks you should have kind of everything and participate in everything. But how can you do that, right? There's so much out there. How does anyone have the ability simply to follow everything like that?
Well, we have these ETFs, and the ETFs follow indexes. And so you have baskets of stocks. You can easily tap into a whole sector or a whole group of a particular asset class by owning the ETF. So I think it's easier today than it's ever been to tap into a very broad portfolio if you want to.
So let me turn the microphone now over to Miranda Marquit, who I think is probably the biggest opponent of ETFs. You hate ETFs and anything to do with indexing, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. Just yes. Stop indexing.
Just,
no, of course not.
No one should.
I sense the sarcasm is strong with this one.
Yeah, I was building up to a sarcastic punchline. But you know, with all of the hundreds or gazillions of ETFs out there, and if we follow Linda's model of having large, mid, small, international, short-term, long-term, commodity, everything, how do you actually analyze these things to find the ones that at the end of the day you're going to put money on the table and buy them?
Yeah, so in the end, what I really like to do is, you know, focus on asset allocation and geographic diversity, because for the most part, I really like really broad-based ETFs. So I'm going to find an S&P 500 ETF, say, for broad-based exposure to the U.S. market. I am going to find, they have the MSCI World Market Index to get that global diversity added in there on top of the U.S. markets. I have an emerging market index ETF, but it's also, once again, broad-based. It pulls in a lot. And then of course, I've got an ETF that follows U.S. Treasuries. So I get that bond part of my asset allocation. And because I do like a little exposure to real estate, I have a REIT ETF, which is a collection of real estate investment trusts. So, you know, I try and make it as simple as possible without having to analyze a whole lot. And a lot of the time what it comes down to...
I'm just loving how you say this is simple. This is sounding like you really have to know what you're doing to pick these different ones, or are you just simply picking the broadest one in each category?
Yeah, so I'm trying to pick something very broad in each category, and part of it has to do with saying, okay, where can I go to get low-cost ETFs? I know we don't, you know, cost shouldn't be the number one thing to focus on, but if you can go to a place like Vanguard or Schwab or whatever it is that says, okay, we have a collection of no transaction fee ETFs with very low expense ratios, and you want to use that particular broker, then you look and see, okay, what are their broad-based ETFs in each category? And you know, you get them without the transaction fee because they're branded. You get them with a low expense ratio, and it kind of helps you screen them out pretty easily. In my case, for my long-term retirement portfolio, I am with Joe's favorite thing, a robo-advisor, and I'm with Betterment. They're not paying me to say this, but that's what I use for my long-term retirement portfolio. They know my risk tolerance. They kind of choose the ETFs for me in an asset allocation that I like.
I think it is even easier than all this, Doug. I think that if you start with the end in mind and you find out what return you need to meet your goal based on the amount of money that you're putting aside, then you go to the efficient frontier and you find historically what mix of assets, which is going to be a wide range, like Dr. French is talking about, of assets, and then you rebalance over time. I think it takes care of itself. I think that's the perfect portfolio.
So just comment on why past performance, in fact, is an indicator of future returns?
Well, it's not an absolute indicator, which is why you have to keep adjusting to where the efficient frontiers move. But if you look over even long periods of time, the efficient frontier doesn't move a ton. So while it isn't exactly efficient for the future, the past has kind of shown us that while it's going to be a little bit of a moving target, not a drastically moving target.
So how do you feel about managers potentially adding value, meaning people looking, let's say, at the efficient frontier or even just readjusting the overall asset allocation in order to try and benefit from certain moves that might be coming up in the market? Or do you feel it's just kind of a wash to go with a manager?
I think inside of those asset classes, I think that's when you can decide when you want to be active and passive. And I love the argument that Dr. French makes that, listen, it's a zero-sum game. So if you're out there being active, you've got a bunch of fees. And I'm not even going to restate, everybody heard what he said. I thought it was a compelling argument for passive. But certainly, if you can find the person who's hot this year that can beat it, or, you know, like we talk about with the Buzz Index, in some places find algorithms that might be working toward tweaking to get a higher return in one of those asset classes. All the efficient frontier does is shows you what the asset classes you should be in. I think it's up to you to decide active versus passive inside of that if you want to find alpha.
Wait, what if our listeners are looking to find the efficient frontier? Where do you suggest that they find it?
Oh, there's cool websites online. I found one recently. There's a cool efficient frontier portfolio that's free at portfoliovisualizer.com/efficient-frontier.
Cool. Thanks.
So Linda, when you're making your decisions about large, medium, small, the whole set that you spoke about, it sounds to me, it's to a certain extent, that you are managing the portfolio on your own. So even though you're using tools that are passive, I guess the index funds are considered more passive than anything else, at the end of the day, you're being active because you're making a choice. So either you're hiring yourself to be the manager, which might be a very good idea because, after all, you are Linda P. Jones, or you can hire someone else to do it. Do you not see yourself as managing money? Actually, therefore, you're a manager?
I think basically if you're making the asset allocation decision, you are acting as a manager in a sense. And there are different models out there that you can use. The American Association of Individual Investors has different asset allocation models. You know, different brokerage firms have them. Most firms that are in the financial industry have their own asset allocation models that they recommend. So you can, you know, easily plug into their asset allocation model. The difficulty is just making sure that you have assets plugged into each one, because if you do go with broad-based index investing, sometimes there's a lot of overlap, and sometimes the portfolio can tend to be very weighted toward large cap, and you can miss out on some small caps, for example, and small caps happen to be outperforming large caps this year. So that would be performance that you're leaving on the table if you're not allocated across all the different asset classes, especially for equities.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's important to rebalance. This is one of the reasons, by the way, that the money managers that I work with, even for my own money, I don't hardly do any trading. My own savings, my retirement plan is handled by money managers, because just the act of rebalancing an asset allocation actually takes some thought. It's not just a random thing where you buy, you know, one or two funds. Although it is interesting, I just want to comment on what Miranda said. You know, there are ETFs that are whole world. They really do have an extremely broad exposure to to kind of everything. I'm wondering if that's a tool for someone who wants to really be passive and not have any active management inside. What's your thought on that, Miranda?
You know, that's not a terrible idea, I guess. It's one way to make sure that you are riding the tide of the global gains in the markets. I mean, I do like to have a little bit more diversity than just that, having some bond funds, having some real estate, just to kind of shore it up a little bit. Just having all your eggs in one basket is almost never a good idea, even if it's a really big basket with lots of different kinds of eggs. And so, so, you know, kind of keep that in mind and look at other ways that you can maybe branch out a little bit, or even just add a U.S. index. A lot of the time, these broad world indexes don't include U.S. markets in them. So you'll have to double check to make sure that the U.S. market is included, or you may have to get that separately.
Yeah, and one of the things that you also touched on was using bond funds. And Ken French spoke about the idea of a bond ladder. A bond ladder is when someone wants to invest in the bond market, not through a mutual fund, you could actually buy a bond. A bond is just a loan that you make to a country or to a company, and you lend them the money. Let's say it's a 2-year bond, and they pay you interest. And at the end of 2 years, assuming that they haven't gone out of business, they will pay you back the principal. So a lot of times people who want to invest in bond ladders will buy, they'll diversify not only in many different companies, but they'll diversify over time. And let's say would buy a 2-year bond, a 3-year bond, a 4, 5, 6-year bond. And it's like a ladder. And then when the first bond matures 2 years later, if you don't need the money, you take that money and you put it at the end of the ladder. You buy a 6-year bond at the end. And what this does is normally, not always, but normally longer term bonds have a higher yield. And so if you keep doing this over time, you're going to end up potentially increasing the yield of your portfolio. Now, there are certain risks of investing in bonds altogether, but a lot of people like individual bonds instead of bond funds, because you have a specific date when you know the money's coming back to you and the bond matures, again, assuming they don't default. Joe, do you have a preference between bond funds or individual bonds?
You know, it's funny. I think, Doug, to your point, if you understand the downsides and upsides of both, I think they can both be attractive and they can both be ugly. In that bond ladder, if for some reason you need to break out of the ladder because you miscalculated and you need some money now, and the market has tanked on those bonds. But if you've done the ladder right, maybe you have some that are very short duration, some longer duration, like you said, that some weren't hit as hard as others, but you might have to grab those. Where a bond fund would certainly be down as well. The whole fund may be down, but possibly that dividend that it throws off might be enough money to help you. Now, you could have that in the coupon also. So waiting for maturity versus the manager who's selling, or an exchange traded fund that's rebuying at the end of the maturity and I can get it whenever I want. I don't know that I have an opinion except for understand how they both work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could both be very different depending on who the investor is. Linda, do you have a preference? Are you kind of a bond ladder kind of lady or a bond fund kind of lady?
Well, the way I understand bond ladders, they would require more money in general for people to be able to do that, because you're buying individual bonds. Mm-hmm. And people with smaller amounts to invest are kind of stuck and might not even have that option. They might have to hit more of a bond fund if they're looking to have that allocation in their portfolio. But if someone had enough money to have a bond ladder, I think it's a very good way to go, because you're not subject to the interest rate risk, where when interest rates rise, bond valuations drop. And when you have a bond ladder, they're maturing at a certain date. So even if they fluctuate, they eventually are going to mature at full face value. And so I really like a bond ladder if people can afford to put those in their portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, touching on this interest rate risk thing, Miranda, if you were investing in bond funds and you saw like a short duration bond fund that had, I don't know, let's say a 2% yield, and a longer term duration bond fund that had a 4% yield, which one do you think you'd be more excited about?
Probably the long term one, because I do like long term investing, and look at that yield. But yeah, I mean, you do need to kind of watch out for it. You are going to have some turnover, and there are going to be some losses there. So it is important to double check and look into it. But yeah, I am a big fan of long term investments, and I'd probably, you know, go for the long-term one. But at the same time, you know, there is a time and a place for short-term investments. And a lot of the time when you're looking at short-term investments because of your specific goals or what you're trying to accomplish with your portfolio right now, it can make sense to take something with a lower yield as long as you can, as long as you have a plan for it and it's helping you meet whatever goals you have. So it's really all about where you're at in your financial life and where you're planning to be going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also just to realize that if you choose to buy the longer-term bond fund, that means inside the fund they have longer-term bonds, they will tend to be more volatile. And the longer the term the bonds are inside that fund, the more volatile it'll be, which really means that because bond prices and interest rates move inversely, they move opposite to each other, if you were to buy a short-term bond fund and a long-term bond fund, and interest rates in the world were to move up, like if the Fed decides to raise rates, most likely your long-term bond fund will drop in value more and possibly much more than the short-term bond fund. All right, listen, guys, I think that we are near the end of our time and talking about long-term. I don't want to be too long of a term of a show, but as we're wrapping up, let me just hear what's going on with everyone. Let's start with you, Joe Saul Sehy. What's going on down in the basement on the Stacking Benjamins show?
Yeah, Jocelyn Panetta, she paid her way through college with $125,000 worth of scholarships. So she completely used scholarships to pay her way through. We're going to find out how. And if you're trying to go to school or trying to put people in your family through school, you want to listen to that episode.
Sounds great. And Linda P. Jones, what's going on in your world?
Well, on the Be Wealthy and Smart podcast, I recently did an episode on the best large cap growth ETFs year to date and on a 1, 3, and 5 year basis. So people can take a look and see what has performed well and maybe look at that asset allocation and see what they might want to use for their large cap growth.
And Miranda Marquardt, if people who love your wisdom on the Money Tree podcast want to follow a little bit more of it elsewhere on the web, where can they find you?
Well, actually, I would like to talk a little bit about the Plutus Awards and a special episode of Stacking Benjamins that we recently recorded. So go back to Stacking Benjamins, check that out, and listen to find out a little bit more about the finalists for the Plutus Awards, which will be presented at the end of this month in Dallas.
Ooh, very exciting. And on the Rich as a King website, the Rich as a King podcast, I actually got recently, I noticed that people were really liking the video that we had on the front page. You know, the book is about how the wisdom of chess can be applied to investing. And if you want to know a little bit about it, there's like a 1 or 2 minute video on the homepage at Rich as a King. If you like it, give it a like. And if you don't like it, well, you can give it a like anyway. All right, that's about it for today on the Money Tree podcast. Miranda Marquardt, take us out.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Remember to check us out at moneytreepodcast.com for back episodes and more information about resources that can help you become a better investor. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher and coming soon to Google Play. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.
And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Unless it's a corporate trustee who has a fiduciary responsibility to take care of your money as well as you do. But all right, forget that.